We're back, and joining me in the studio is Jason Berry, the author of City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. Jason, you just walked in while I did my opening, and I was telling you just now off air, you packed a lot of information in 300 pages, a lot of which I kind of knew but didn't really know, and it really put things in a context for me. Really enjoyed it. I'm a slow reader. It reads at a fast pace. Very well done.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Newell, and the chance to be on your show.
So tell us, what led you to want to do this, and how did it work out for you as you were putting it together? Because this book could literally be 3,000 pages long.
Well, it could, and it's about a tenth of that length. And I particularly wanted to have a work, a popular history that people could read and understand without having to spend time, you know, in all the footnotes. I got interested in jazz funerals in the 1990s, early 90s, and I was doing interviews with various musicians, and I kept trying to understand where jazz funerals came from. How did they begin? And the more I began researching the origins of these burial traditions, which are partly African and partly European, at their root, the linear progression of the marching bands out of the European tradition and the circle dances, the ring dances of the enslaved Africans at Congo Square. The more I began to get my viewfinder focused on those two traditions, it forced me to ask the question, well, where did the city come from? How do you explain New Orleans? How do you explain a city where people dance in the streets and wear masks and bury the dead, you know, with celebrations as we have? So the research on the funeral sort of dovetailed into the research on the city. And once I got into the section on Bienville, I was fascinated because of his personality.
You point out in a book that one of the first processions of funerals was Carlos III's funeral that was held at the Cabildo.
It was. This was in 1789, and the setting is fascinating. So the city is now 70 years old in the year before, 1788, and three-fourths of the city burns to the ground right in the space of 6 hours. And so it takes months and months to clean up. You know, it was the equivalent of what Hurricane Katrina was like in 2005. So here they are. They're rebuilding the city. And 13 months later, the word comes from Madrid by ship that Carlos III, the king, has died. And Carlos III put a lot of money into New Orleans. The Spanish, in fact, probably did a better job of managing the city than the French. So they decide they have to have a funeral for him. And I found a document in the Cabildo archive, and it was extraordinary to me, the detail that this Cabildo scribe went into in describing this lavish procession through the streets. And he referred to all the people processing as the illustrious body, capital I, capital B. And the illustrious body is figures throughout this long description. And the only thing they don't say is what kind of music the band played at the front of the procession. So this was really the first major funeral for a notable.
And there were many that had occurred over the years. I think there's a part of the book that refers to the Andrew Jackson procession through the city of New Orleans upon his death.
There were processions in New Orleans for major figures whenever they died. You find this throughout the 19th century. And I think there's a certain turning point that happens in 1863 during the Civil War. André Cayo, who was a leader of the Louisiana Native Guards, African-American, had fought against the Confederacy. His body lay on the field for almost 6 weeks. And while that happened, there was a séance. I have a whole chapter on this, of these Creoles of color who are summoning spirits of the dead. Cayo's spirit speaks to this seance while the body is decaying out in, at Port Hudson. When they finally bring him back and have the funeral, it is the largest funeral procession of African Americans, using that same narrative spine, if you will, of the linear movement of all these bands, all of these benevolent societies. So funerals become major events in New Orleans, and what gradually happens is that the old ring dances of the slaves fall in behind the linear procession of the brass bands, the coming together of the ring and the line.
And in several places in the book, there's also talk about the Indian influence in a lot of this as well.
I didn't know a great deal about the history of Indians in Louisiana until I read the book. Until I wrote the book and read other people's book. I stand corrected, Newell. Bienville early on had a series of collisions with the Natchez Empire upriver at present-day Natchez, Mississippi, which was part, of the great French territory. And the descriptions of the funerals of those dynastic figures are pretty grisly reading. I mean, they engaged in human sacrifice.
Yeah.
And, for people who tend to think in terms of the Indians as only victimized people of our history, I think you get a different slant by understanding how Bienville and these, French pioneers thought.
I was kind of shocked, I guess, both politically, strategically, and otherwise, the importance that the Indians played. Bienville had an on-again, off-again relationship with them. And while it was on-again, very much a, kind of a symbiotic relationship of managing the population at large for some sense of order and structure, as loose as it was back then, because all of the governance was from overseas.
Well, it was. And if you think about it, much of the money came from France, and it was parlayed out to this, small area along the Mississippi. Bienville needed the Indians. He needed the Choctaw. He needed the Akalapissa. He needed these other tribes, the Bayagula tribe. He needed them to anchor the food chain. So he's engaging in constant diplomacy with these groups to make sure that all the people in this growing port city, port town, really could be fed. And in the meantime, he's taking the defense of the city out and taking troops and going north into the area around present-day Tupelo or Memphis, North Mississippi, to fight the Chittimacha, who, interestingly, were slave-trading Indians in league with the British. So it's a very complex political story in those years.
It truly was, and that was one part of it that I'd never really heard of before, so it was very interesting from that point. One of the other things that I truly enjoyed in reading the book was kind of the meaning behind the names of so many different landmarks, bodies of waters, streets, neighborhoods. You kind of know a little bit about it, and growing up in New Orleans, and then I think you really did a great job of laying that out in the book.
Well, thank you so much. I was always curious about where the name Pontchartrain came from. Some years ago, I heard a wonderful Irish tenor sing a song, "The Lakes of Pontchartrain." Well, Count Pontchartrain was right under Louis XIV, and he was in charge of the colonies. And he bequeathed the title and the job to his son. So there were two counts of Pontchartrain, the younger of whom was Iberville's superior when Iberville and Bienville left and discovered the mouth of the Mississippi in 1699, or I should say rediscovered it after La Salle had done several years earlier. And so by the time Iberville is coming down toward, he's coming via Lake Bourne, to get onto the boats, the big boats that were anchored after their incursion, into the interior. He names one of them Pontchartrain, of course, the big lake, and then Maurepas, the smaller one, which was also the landed title of the grandson of Count Pontchartrain. So we've got royalty out there.
No, it was very interesting. And as well as the streets and the neighborhoods, Faubourg Marigny, Faubourg Treme.
The
list just goes on and on.
Treme is the one that interested me because Claude Treme was a hat maker who had come from France, and he is arrested for shooting a slave at night. And Governor Miro, the Spanish governor, put him in jail for 5 years. So he gets out and he marries a wealthy woman who owns a great deal of land in present-day Treme neighborhood and in short order begins selling off land. Many of these plots are going to free persons of color, and it's on one side and Congo Square is on the other, and so the neighborhood ends up being named for me.
You know, it's kind of interesting. It was, as I was reading through that, it was, you know, having grown up in Metairie, in the development of those subdivisions, I couldn't help but think this was kind of like the first subdivision that was developed, you know,
yeah.
just outside the hustle and bustle of the inner city, you know, because at that time, Treme seemed like a far distance in many respects, right?
Well, it was. And, you know, if you think about the role Bayou St. John played, and by the way, when you talk about naming, Bienville named Bayou St. John after, of course, John the Baptist, the saint. But Bienville's name was Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne, Sieur de Bienville. I mean, he had a title. So he's also naming the bayou after himself.
Right.
Irony not everybody can appreciate or knows, at least. I hope they appreciate it now. But so, you know, Bayou St. John becomes this area that the city sort of follows gradually in expanding outward toward the lake and then, of course, going west toward what becomes Metairie and Jefferson Parish.
One of the other things that was kind of interesting, and albeit there wasn't a map of it, you talk several times in the book about them cutting channels,
mm-hmm.
not only out of the Mississippi, but out of Bayou St. John and others to be able to move goods throughout the city. And it seems like there was this just our present-day drainage canals, but there were a number of little tributaries that were cut man-made to be able to move goods a lot easier across the city.
Well, if you think about the Pontchartrain Expressway and meeting up with Interstate 10, which of course you know takes you into the city or out of the city, that was originally the New Basin
Canal. The New Basin Canal.
Yeah,
right.
The New Basin Canal, which was cut basically from Lake Pontchartrain coming down the route of you know the present day expressway. And it was there to bring goods to what was the Treme market right about. And there was a Rampart Street market, which was right about the site of today's Greyhound bus station and Amtrak station. So you see the different arteries of transportation that we now have essentially followed the river passageways that the early engineers of the city cut.
I did want to touch on something before we move to more modern days that are addressed in the book. New Orleans, the city that Care forgot, in reading the book, it maybe should be coined the city that should never have happened, right?
Or the city that forgot to care, depending on how you look at it. Well, Lawrence Powell, the eminent historian at Tulane who did the book The Accidental City, writes about that. And the city is, and by the way, Larry, I should really give him a shout out. He was very kind. He read this book chapter by chapter as I wrote it and was a terrific internal critic, which one always needs. My wife was the other. Melanie, thank you, my dear.
We all have those.
We do. We all need guidance. I often say that the only two issues for a man in upper midlife are obedience and spare parts. But New Orleans is where it is because of Bienville's sheer force of personality. He wanted it here, because he knew the area, he knew the Indian tribes, and he pretty much stiff-armed the French superiors in putting it here.
Absolutely. I found that to be very interesting because they wanted it in Biloxi, they wanted it in Dolphin Island, they wanted it in a number of other places.
Manshack was a big runner-up, but he would not hear of it. It's interesting to speculate what it might be like if it was at Manshack.
All righty. We'll continue this conversation with Jason Berry, City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. We'll be right back. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. We have the author Jason Berry in the house about his new book, City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300, a great read. Jason, what in your research for the book, what was the thing that surprised you the most, that it just created pause for you?
There were two, actually, and I'll try to do them quickly. The first was Claiborne. I really had not known a lot about Claiborne until I began research.
First Louisiana governor.
Well, he's appointed by Thomas Jefferson. As the governor of the Orleans Territory, and then he later runs and is elected. But he comes down here. He had been the governor, appointed governor of the Mississippi Territory. This guy grows up in Virginia. He's basically an aristocrat. He's a lawyer. He was on the Tennessee Supreme Court at the age of 21, if you can imagine that. So he comes down to New Orleans. He's got a 17-year-old bride from Nashville. And the wife and the little girl are here barely a short period of time before they both die of yellow fever. He then marries a French Creole from Opelousas. She bears him a son, and then she dies of yellow fever. So this is a guy who is trying to ingratiate himself with all these French and Spanish-speaking people, and he loses his first two wives. He finally marries a 16-year-old Spanish Creole who gives him sort of the stability that anybody in public life needs. And then when the Battle of New Orleans comes, he has a terrific struggle in getting these French and Spanish-speaking folks who are not really clear on where they stand with the United States of America to help defend the city. The other person who really drew me in was Pierre Cazenove. He was a free man of color in the 1850s. He was a cabinet maker who began making coffins and had a booming clientele with white aristocrats. And then he gets the training to embalm the dead. And during the yellow fever epidemics, that was quite a tool to have. And I won't go into all the grisly details. But this guy then in the late 1850s begins hiring bands to accompany the buckboard hearses to the cemeteries with high-spirited music coming out. And the Times-Picayune runs a long editorial condemning him, saying this is, or condemning the practice of funerals with music. They didn't like it at all. They didn't get very far on that one.
Yeah. I also, in the book, you talk about the influence of the Jesuits and the Ursuline.
The Jesuits and the Ursuline sisters in many ways are sort of opposite faces of the same coin. The Ursulines came from Rouen in France, and their mission was a Jesuit priest, Father Bobois, persuades them to come, and the given reason why they come to New Orleans is to run a hospital. And they have an agreement with the colony that you've got to build us a cloistered place to live. Well, they arrive. Bienville has been recalled to France, so they're staying in Bienville's house. There's no cloistered convent. So they ignore the order to run the hospital, and they open a school,
right,
which, of course, today is Ursuline Academy. And so they're educating young girls, even the children of slaves who worked for them. Meantime, the Jesuits come in, and they're getting in conflicts with the monks who are...
Let's stop right there, if you don't mind, and we'll pick it up on the Jesuits.
Sure.
We got to get to a break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Jason Berry, author of City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. We'll be right back after the break. This is Newell on WWDL. We're back, and we're talking to Jason Berry, author of City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. We left off, we were talking about the Jesuit influence. You had just finished talking about the Ursuline nuns' influence.
Well, the Jesuits really had a fascinating role in the early continuing history of the city as well. But in 1767, after establishing quite a presence here, including a large plantation, there was a movement in France by a group called the Jansenists who really went after the Jesuits. They lost favor with the kings of Europe. And the government in New Orleans ousted them. This was happening in other parts of the Western world. And so they barely existed for a generation and a half afterwards before they finally came back in the 1830s. And By the end of Reconstruction, the Jesuits were a well-established religious presence. Loyola, at turn of the century, Jesuit High School also came into existence. One of the interesting things about the Jesuits is how Bienville, when he was recalled to France, he was more than recalled. He was basically sacked, and they brought him back. He was broke. And on the boat going to France, he's befriended by Father Bobois, who is going with these Indians from Illinois to meet Louis XV. It's an amazing scene when the Indians meet the king. And poor Bienville is ostracized by then, but he manages to sell some of his land to the Jesuit, who sort of keeps him alive financially.
Right, right. It was very interesting. And I think one of the things was there was this friction because the Jesuits were very aggressive politically. They were very involved politically, and there were a number of folks in the leadership of the city that was very turned off by that.
Well, they were, and part of it, too, you got to put yourself in the mind of the moment, of the time. This was a time when the church was a slave-owning institution. I'm talking about the mid-1700s. The Ursulines had slaves. The Jesuits had slaves. And all these landed aristocrats, if you will, who had huge plantations, resented the church. No, I shouldn't say all. Some of them resented the church and felt they had an unfair advantage. So they had their enemies as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So coming forward a little bit, the first vestiges, I guess, of a political organization in the city in 1888, the Young Men's Democratic Association.
Right. People think today of the Democratic Party as the liberal blue force in American politics. I mean, back then, these guys were bristling at the fact that New Orleans was no longer a center for slavery. So, you know, we're now in Reconstruction. And they were doing everything they could to re-cement the power of white supremacy, which is much of what the battles in Reconstruction were about.
Yeah. And if you want to meet Jason Berry tonight at 6 p.m., he'll be at the Garden District Bookstore. Tomorrow night, Octavia Books at 6 p.m., Thursday night at East Jeff Library at 7 p.m., and Friday night at NOMA, the New Orleans Museum of Art, at 7:30 p.m. for book signings on each of those evenings. We'll be right back with Jason. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. All right, we're back, and we're talking to Jason Berry, author of City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. Jason, and we'll continue this conversation through the break, because we're only halfway through the book, and there's so many different things I want you to share with the listening audience. We're getting a lot of texts coming in asking questions and so forth. One of the things in history of this city that I didn't realize the amount of influence that we had was during Prohibition. Kind of blew me away. You know, you think about the speakeasies on the Eastern Seaboard in Chicago, and you're talking about gangster land. But during Prohibition, this city, almost all of this liquor flowed through here at one point in time.
Well, New Orleans was an incoming port for illegal alcohol. They were shipping in rum from Honduras. The Caribbean, in fact, became a kind of transshipment point. People think of Joseph Kennedy importing the scotch, in New York and Massachusetts, which he certainly did to great profit. But a lot of the liquor and wine that was coming in to New Orleans was coming via Central America, especially from Europe. I mean, look, you think about restaurants like Antoine's and Galatoire's. We think of them today for their enormous wine cellars. Imagine what it was like being a restaurateur. And you're serving great Creole food or even a small Italian restaurant. There were many Italian restaurants in New Orleans by this time, huge wave of Sicilian immigrants that I write about. So how are they going to serve dinner without wine unless they pay off the cops? And that's what everybody did. The police department was getting bribes from everybody to look the other way. So if ever there was a place that was not made for Prohibition, it was New Orleans. One quick note. It reminded me, as I did this section, on Père Antoine in the early 19th century. He was actually a Spanish priest, Antonio de Sedea, who came to New Orleans as an agent of the Inquisition. Mm-hmm. And if you can imagine sending someone from the Inquisition to New Orleans, even the Spanish governors realized this is not going to work. We can't have this guy going into these homes where these French planters have, books by, illegal French writers during the Enlightenment. So New Orleans has always sort of winked at the law, I think.
Yeah, very interesting. And what I also found interesting is that it was a confluence of a number of folks at different ethnic backgrounds that helped one another during Prohibition.
Yeah, I use the term map of the world neighborhoods in the latter part of the book because even with gentrification today, I mean, we are a city of migrants. We're very much a city that has been shaped by the traditions of the French, of the Spanish, certainly African-Americans or Africans, you know, the African folkways in this city. And in a way, it has given us a kind of face to the world that now the city markets as a place apart.
So when let's move forward to obviously the 50s and 60s, you spend a lot of time talking about this same confluence that seems to be rubbing against other trends of the segregationists and stuff, and a lot of difficulties in meandering through that process as well.
Yeah, to me, it all comes together. The argument of the book is that the city has been shaped by a long tension between a culture of spectacle and a city of laws. The African tradition of slave dances, later subsumed by carnival, the French and Spanish finery and processions and so forth. All of that pushing against a legal system that until the 1960s was anchored in white supremacy. And in a sense, the culture won out, which is the great discovery I made about St. Peter Street in the 1960s.
Well, we're going to talk more about that. I'm going to hold you over for some more time in the next hour. We want to try and answer some of the questions on the text line as well and get through what I think is a very fascinating part of the book. You know, as you bring this to this summation and this this thought process about, you know, why we fought so hard to come back here after Katrina. I mean, we were completely displaced. It was almost a repeat of history because that happened so many times to the city. We'll be right back after the break. This is Newell on WWL. We're back. I was able to negotiate a few more minutes with Jason Berry, author of City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. On a Blue Runner opinion poll, how knowledgeable are you about New Orleans history? Most of you, like me, somewhat, 63%, 21% vary, and 16% not at all. This is a great book to start with, for sure. Touches on a lot of different issues over a long period, 300 years. I wanted to talk for a moment because I'd heard her story from different perspectives. Mother Catherine Seals and the founder of the Manger, a compound in the Lower Nine.
Mother Catherine was one of the fascinating, among the most fascinating people I researched. I should add, this is a character-driven history. It is absolutely anchored in factual detail and historical research, but I tried to make it as much like a novel as I could, as a nonfiction narrative. She was an illiterate faith healer who, in the 1920s, established in the Lower Nine a huge compound where she took in pregnant girls or teenage women, battered women. She even took in families of people who were not able to survive. If you will, she fed the masses. And she had regular concerts in this big tent and a stage. Harold Dejean, the longtime leader of the Olympia Brass Band, got his start as a 14-year-old there. Ernie Cagnoletti, who was a renowned local jazz man for many years, played at Preservation Hall. He met his wife there. I got a tremendous amount of information from his daughter, Anne Cagnoletti, who very kindly shared a family history. And the number of people whose forebears met in the manger is really quite striking. When Mother Catherine died, she had one of the largest funerals ever. She was a healer, literally. And she used devices like if someone, you know, had a rupture or some sort of problem on the arm, a break, she would take a live chicken, cut it in half, and literally put it over, the break. And I found a woman in Canada, a doctor and a historian who has written about Vatican miraculous cures and how the Vatican does this documentation. And I sent her all of these accounts that I had unearthed, and she gave me abundant information on the fact that all of those techniques are traditional folk remedies that do have a way of helping people. Obviously, hospitals are better.
Right.
But she was an amazing person who is remembered yet today.
And influenced so many different people's lives that went on to influence New Orleans music, culture, restaurants. Incredible.
She was really one of those people who is sort of an unsung figure in the history of the city. And I was looking for people like that to profile in the book.
Then Sister Gertrude Morgan.
Gertrude Morgan just jumped off the pages for me. I will state it bluntly. I fell in love with her. She was a largely illiterate African-American evangelist who comes down from Alabama in the 1930s and sets up shop with two other reverend mothers. They were taking in orphans, street kids. She goes to parish prison and sings for prisoners. And then right after the Industrial Canal, the bridge, Claiborne Bridge over the Industrial Canal is built, 1957, she and Mother Parker move into this house in the Lower Nine. She has a vision that she is a bride of Christ. And I compared her to St. Catherine of Siena and William Blake as people who had direct contact with God, because if you look at the flood of paintings she generated, it is extraordinary the way in which she portrays herself in these settings of divine worship. Jesus is my airplane. Here you are going through the sky with angels above. I mean, she had visions. I don't know how we explain that. Psychiatrists would run up against a brick wall. But there she is in Preservation Hall in the 1960s. She's being represented by Larry Borenstein, the wily founder of Preservation Hall, along with Alan Jaffe. Borenstein, who had been put in jail three times in Mexico for trying to get artifacts out of the country. He didn't succeed. But with her, he had success. So he's selling all of her paintings. All this is going on while the Freedom Riders are coming through and the city is trying to hold on to this crumbling edifice of segregation. And Alan Jaffe, who is, of course, white, is playing with black musicians in Preservation Hall. Well, what do they do? Are they going to arrest this guy? What's that going to do to tourism? So it's a real turning point in the history of the city that if I can mix metaphors, mined for and milked for all it was worth in this narrative.
And what was interesting is, as once again I'll use this term, it was almost that repeat of history of that friction between folks of different ethnic backgrounds that we've had over time, you know, the French, the Spanish, on and the Portuguese, on and on and on. And then, as I said earlier, I was surprised by the Indian influence and that kind of on-again, off-again friction as well. It seems to repeat itself a lot of times in the history of New Orleans.
It does. And I go back to what I said earlier in the interview, that this is a city that formed map of the world neighborhoods where these various ethnic the lines of ethnic peoples came and met. The birth of jazz is probably the most striking example. But the story of the city to me is this steady tension between culture and the law, and invariably, culture wins out.
All righty. Jason Berry, City of a Million Dreams, History of New Orleans at Year 300, tonight at Garden District Bookstore, 6 o'clock, tomorrow, Octavia Books at 6 p.m., Thursday at East Jeff Library at 7, and NOMA, New Orleans Museum of Art, 7:30 on Friday. Thank you so much for spending time with us. We really appreciate
Thank you. Great pleasure. Thank
you. All righty. We'll be right back after the break. This is Newell on WWL.